Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Mardell. Reading Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller. Chapter 4. There was no doubt whatsoever in the mind of the spectator that this caress, provoked or unprovoked, was not agreeable to its recipient. The young man was large and heavy, and she was minute and probably weak, but the violence of her recoil was sufficient to free her within a second. Her strength, thought Tucker, was as the strength of 10, and he hoped it was for the reason alleged by the poet. She stood an instant, looking at her visitor, and then she said in a tone that no well-trained dog would have attempted to disobey, "Go away, go home, and please don't ever come back." Tucker was deeply moved. It is to be feared that he forgot Mrs. Faulkner, forgot his plans for his friend's protection, forgot everything except that he had just heard himself described as a hero of romance by a girl of superlative charms, and that girl had just been the object of the obviously unwelcome attentions of another. He recognized that the stern but sympathetic husband on the stage would have instantly come to the rescue of the weak young wife in any similar situation, and he determined on the instant to do so. But he found a slight difficulty in making up his mind as to the particular epigram with which he should enter. In fact, he could think of nothing except, "Jane Ellen, is the ice cream ready?" That obviously wouldn't do. While, however, he hesitated above, the dialogue below rushed on unimpeded. "The truth is," said the young man with the violence of one who feels himself at least partially in the wrong, "the truth is that you are a cold, cruel woman who thinks of nothing but her own amusement. You don't care anything about the sufferings of others, and in my opinion, Lily is worth 10 of you."
"Then why don't you go and kiss Lily?"
"Because Lily isn't that sort. She wouldn't stand it." This reply, not unnaturally, angered the cook.
"And do you mean to say I stand it? I can't help it. I'm so horribly small. But if I could, I'd kill you, Randolph, and as it is, I hate you for doing it. Hate you more than you have any idea."
"You know very well it's your own fault. You tempted me."
"How could I know about your silly lack of self-control?"
"You've always pretended to like me."
"Just what I did, pretended, but I'll never have to pretend again, thank heaven. I don't really like you, and I never did, not since we were children."
"You'll be sorry for saying that when you're calmer."
"I may be sorry for saying it, but I'll think it as long as I live."
"I pity the man who marries you, my girl. You've a bitter tongue."
"You'd marry me tomorrow if you could."
"I would not."
"You would."
"Not if you were the last woman in the world."
"Good night."
"Goodbye."
The culprit seized his hat and rushed away through the shadows before Tucker had time to think the dignified rebuke that he had intended. There was a pause. He was conscious that an opportunity had slipped from him. He knew now what he ought to have said. He should have asked the young fellow, who was clearly a gentleman, far above Jane Ellen in social position, whether that was the way he would have treated a girl in his own mother's drawing room, and whether he considered that less chivalry was due to a working girl than to a woman of leisure. Though his great opportunity was gone, he decided to do whatever remained. After a short hesitation, he descended a flight of steps at one end of the piazza. The kitchen opened before him, large and cavernous. 2 lamps hardly served to light it. It was red-tiled. Round its walls hung large, bright copper saucepans, and on shelves of oak along its sides were rows of dark blue and white plates and dishes. Tucker was prepared to find the cook in tears, in which case he had a perfectly definite idea as to what to do. But the disconcerting young woman was moving rapidly about the kitchen, humming to herself. She held a small but steaming saucepan in her hand, which was, as Tucker swiftly reflected, a much better weapon than the handle of an ice cream freezer.
"Good evening, Jane Ellen," he said graciously.
"Good evening, sir."
She did not even look in his direction, but bent witch-like over a cauldron.
"I wish to speak to you," he said, "about that little incident of this morning. You must not think that I am by nature cruel or indifferent to animals. On the contrary, I am a life member in the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Them. I love animals." And as if to prove his words, he put out his hand and gently pulled the ears of Willoughby, who was asleep in a chair. Cats' ears are extraordinarily sensitive, and Willoughby woke up and withdrew his head with a jerk. Willoughby's mistress, on the other hand, made no reply whatsoever. Indeed, it would have been impossible to be sure she had heard. How different she is, thought Tucker, in the presence of a man she really respects and recognizes as her superior. All the levity and coquetry disappear from her bearing. "I was truly sorry," he went on, drawing nearer and nearer to the range, "to have been the occasion."
"You'd better be careful, sir," she said, still without looking at him. "These sauces sometimes boil over."
And as she spoke, she put a spoon into the pan, and the next instant Tucker felt a small but burning drop fall upon his hand. He startled back with an exclamation.
"I am truly sorry, sir," she said, "to have been the occasion."
He glanced at her sharply. Was she conscious of repeating his own phrase? She seemed to be wholly absorbed in her task. He noticed how prettily the hair grew at the back of her neck, how small and well-shaped were her ears. His manner became even more protecting.
"I am an older man than your employer," he began.
"Yes, indeed, sir."
He decided not to notice the interruption.
"I am older and have seen more of life. I understand more, perhaps, of the difficulties of the young and, I must say, a beautiful woman, Jane Ellen."
"Why must you say that, sir?"
Her eyes fixed themselves on his.
"Because it is the truth, my dear child."
He again approached the range, but as a fountain instantly rose from the sauce, he retreated and continued.
"I would like, if any little troubles in the household arise, to know that you would look upon me as a friend, both you and Willoughby."
He thought it not amiss to introduce the comic note now and again.
"I have some influence with Mr. Crane. I should be glad to do you a good turn."
"You can do me one now, sir."
"Pray, tell me what it is."
"You can go away and let me get the dinner."
"You want me to go?"
"The kitchen is no place for gentlemen."
Tucker laughed tolerantly. "And did you think so 10 minutes ago?" For the second time she looked in his direction as she asked quickly,
"What do you mean?"
"Your last visitor was not so respectful."
She had put the saucepan down, and so he approached and tried to take her hand. Perhaps this is as good a time as any to describe the sensation of taking Jane Ellen's hand. The ordinary mortal put out an ordinary hand and touched something, presumably flesh and blood, but so light, so soft, so pliant, that it seemed literally to melt into the folds of his palm, so that even after the hand had been withdrawn, and in this instance it was instantly withdrawn, the feeling seemed to remain, and Tucker found himself staring at his own fingers to see if they did not still bear traces of that remarkable contact. It was just at this moment that Brindlebury entered the kitchen and said, in a tone which no one could have considered respectful, that the motor was coming up the drive. Tucker was more apt to meet an awkward situation, and the situation was slightly awkward, by an additional dignity of manner rather than by any ill-considered action. "Ah," he now observed, "in that case I think I must go and meet it." "I think I would if I were you," replied the boy, and adding to the cook, in case there was any mistake about his meaning, "seems to me there are too many men in this kitchen in the course of the day."
"Well, goodness knows, they're not here to please me," said Jane Ellen.
Tucker, who understood that this reply had to be made, wished nevertheless that she had not made it with such a convincing sincerity of manner. He turned and left the kitchen, and as he went up the piazza stairs, became aware that the boy was following him. He stood still at the top, therefore, and asked with that hectoring tone which many people think so desirable to use with servants.
"What's this? You wish to speak to me?"
The boy hardly troubled to approximate civility as he answered,
"Yes, I just wanted to tell you that Jane Ellen is my sister."
Tucker laughed with indulgent good humor.
"Indeed," he said. "Well, I cannot confess, Brindlebury, to taking a very deep interest in your family relations." "It's this much interest that I don't want you going into the kitchen to talk to her."
"Tut, tut," said Tucker. "I think I shall have to report you to your employer."
"And I may have to report you."
This was so beyond the bounds of convention that Tucker thought best to ignore it. He merely turned on his heel and walked into the house, where in the hall he found the two Falconer ladies taking off their coats. Mrs. Falconer was all graciousness. She was engaged in unwinding a veil from her face, and as she freed her nose from its meshes, she said briskly,
"And how is the housekeeping going? How is your staff working?"
Crane got them into the drawing room where tea was waiting. Mrs. Falconer spoke to him, but she cast a secret glance of question at Tucker. Under most circumstances, he would have replied by raising his eyebrows, shrugging his shoulders, closing his eyes, or conveying in some manner the true reply to her demand. But now he merely looked into his teacup, which he was diligently stirring. He found himself uncertain what to do. He had no intention of mentioning the afternoon's incidents to Crane. He did not wish, he told himself, to tell on a poor young woman and perhaps deprive her of her job. Besides, it is very difficult to tell a story in which you have been an eavesdropper and tell it with any sort of flourish and satisfaction. The geography of the balcony was such that he would have to confess either to having leaned as far over the rail as possible, or else to having been in the kitchen. But the insolence of the boy Brindlebury put a new face on the matter. He deserved reproof, to say nothing of the fact that he might tell in a mistaken desire to protect his sister from annoyance. To tell any of this to Mrs. Falconer was to put a weapon in her hands, which she would not fail to use to get Jane Ellen out of the house within 24 hours. Tucker's first idea was that he did not wish Jane Ellen to leave the house. But, as he sat stirring his tea, another thought came to him. Why should she not leave? Why should she not become his own cook?
Crane, after all, only offered her employment for a few weeks, whereas he decided that it would be better for Crane to get rid of her, he decided, as he put it to himself, to be perfectly open with his friend. If Crane turned her out, then he, Tucker, would be there, helpful and ready, like the competent, middle-aged hero of the drama, whom she herself had so well described. He joined but little in the conversation round the tea-table, and Mrs. Falconer, watching him narrowly, feared from his gravity that something serious had happened, that the situation was worse than she had imagined. What, she wondered, had occurred in the last 24 hours? What had those evil women with manicured nails accomplished in her absence? She maneuvered 2 or 3 times to get a word with Tucker, but he seemed unconscious of her efforts. When at last they all agreed it was time to dress for dinner, Tucker laid a detaining hand on his host's arm. "Can I just have a word with you, Bert?" he said. Crane always felt like a naughty child when his friend spoke to him like this. "Wouldn't later do?" he asked. "I want to get a bath before dinner, and if we keep it waiting, we may spoil some of those wonderful dishes that star-eyed beauty in the kitchen is preparing for us." "It is about her I want to speak to you." Both ladies and Crane turned instantly at these words. Then the Falconers, with a strong effort of self-control, left the room, and the two men were alone. "Well, what is it?" said Crane rather sharply. Tucker was now all suavity. "I'm afraid, after all," he began, sitting down and swinging one leg over the other, "that you won't be able to keep that young person. I'm afraid Mrs. Falconer was right. Women know these things at a glance." "What things?" "Why, I mean that in spite of her good dinner, I'm afraid your cook, Bert, is not. Well, I'd better tell you just what is in my mind." "Surely, if you can," said his host and client. "I went out for a little while about dusk on the back piazza, which you know is just above the kitchen, and a conversation below is audible there. At first I did not pay much attention to the murmur of voices, but gradually I became aware that someone was making love to Jane Ellen." "Who was it?" asked Crane. "That wretched boy, that smug butler?" "Alas, no," said Tucker. "If it had been one or the other servants, I should not have thought it much harm. Unhappily, it was a young gentleman, a person so much her social superior." "Well, my dear fellow, you get the idea." "No one you knew, of course?" "I never saw him before." "How did you see him at all?" This was the question that Tucker had been anticipating. "Why, to tell you the truth, Bert," he said, "when I realized what was going on, I thought it my duty, for your sake, to find out. I looked over the railing, and just at the psychological moment when he kissed her." Crane was tapping a cigarette thoughtfully on the palm of his hand and did not answer at once. When he did, he looked up with a smile and said, "Lucky dog is what I say, Tuck." "I don't think," answered his friend, that is quite the right attitude for you to assume." What do you think I should do?" "Dismiss the girl." Another pause. "Or," added Tucker magnanimously, "if you shrink from the interview, I shall be very glad to do it for you." Crane looked up. "No, thank you," he said. "I think you have done quite enough. I should not dream of imposing upon you further." He walked to the bell and rang it. Smithfield appeared. "Tell the cook I want to see her," he said. After a brief absence, Smithfield returned. "I beg pardon, sir," he said, "but the cook says
If she leaves dinner now, it will be spoiled, and won't after dinner do?
Crane nodded. You know, said Tucker when they were again alone, it is not always necessary to tell servants why you are dispensing with their services, you might say.
Much to his surprise, Crane interrupted him with a laugh.
My dear Tuck, he said, you don't really suppose, do you, that I am going to dismiss that peerless woman just because you saw an ill-mannered fellow kiss her? I shall administer a telling rebuke with a slight sketch of my notions on female deportment. It would take more than that to induce me to send her away. Indeed, I was thinking of taking her north with me.
This was a serious suggestion, but Tucker could think of no better way to meet it than to raise his eyebrows, and Crane went off whistling to dress for dinner. He whistled, not only going upstairs, but he whistled in his bath and while he was shaving. The sound annoyed Tucker in the next room.
It almost seems, he thought, as if he were glad to see the woman again on any terms. And yet he, Tucker, knew that she considered Crane quite a commonplace young man, not at all like a hero in the third act. The way Crane had taken his suggestions was distressing. Tucker did not feel that he thoroughly understood what was in the younger man's mind. His first intention, to tell Mrs. Falconer nothing, began to fade. It would have been all very well if Burton had been sensible and had been willing to send the cook away, and he, Tucker, had been able to engage her to ignore the whole matter to Mrs. Falconer. Indeed, it would have been hard to explain it. But, of course, if Burton was going to be obstinate about it, Mrs. Falconer's aid might be absolutely necessary. After all, he thought, candor is the best policy among friends. He dressed quickly and was not mistaken in his belief that Mrs. Falconer would have done the same. She was waiting for him in the drawing room. They had a clear 15 minutes before dinner.
Now, tell me, my dear Solon, she said, just what you think of the situation.
I think badly of it.
Yes, said Mrs. Falconer, not yet quite appreciating the seriousness of his tone.
I do myself, that idiotic housemaid Lily. I could have told him that name would never do. Hooked me twice wrong and left my daughter's dirty boots on top of her best tea gown.
Ah, if incompetence were all we had to complain of.
The cook?
Is perfections, as far as cooking goes. But in other respect, really, my dear Mrs. Falconer, I am in doubt whether you should let your daughter stay in this house, at least until Burton comes to his senses.
You must tell me just what you mean.
Tucker decided to tell the story reluctantly.
Why, it happened this afternoon. Burton was away with his horses, and quite by accident I came upon his pretty cook in the arms of a strange young man, a person vastly her social superior, one of the young landholders of the neighborhood, I should say. Seemed to assume the most confident right to be in Burton's kitchen. A man he may know in the hunting field may have to dinner tomorrow. I don't know who he is, but certainly a gentleman.
How very unpleasant, said Mrs. Falconer. Did the woman take in that you had detected her?
Yes, and seemed quite unabashed.
And now I suppose you are hesitating whether or not to tell Burton.
Tucker was naturally cautious.
What would you advise?
It is your duty to tell him at once and get such a person out of the house.
You think if I told him he would dismiss her?
I am confident he would unless...
Unless he himself has some interest in her.
Said Tucker with a deep sigh.
That's the question. At this moment, Miss Falconer, looking very handsome in a sapphire-colored dress, came in. She, too, perhaps, had expected that somebody would be dressed a little ahead of time for the sake of a few minutes' private talk. If so, she was disappointed.
"Oh, Cora," said her mother brightly, "let us hear how the piano sounds, and give us some of that delightful Chopin you were playing last evening."
Cora, to show her independence of spirit, sat down and began to play ragtime. But neither of her auditors noticed the difference.
"You mean," whispered Mrs. Falconer, "that you have reason to suppose that Crane himself—"
"Why, to be candid, my dear lady," replied Tucker, "I did tell him. You may have noticed I seemed a trifle abstracted at tea time. I was considering what it was best to do. Well, when you left us, I told him."
"What do you think he said?"
"Lucky dog." That was all. Just lucky dog.
"Meaning you?"
No, meaning the fellow who had been kissing the cook."
"Dear me," said Mrs. Falconer, "how very light-minded."
"It shocked me to have him take it like that, and he would not hear of dismissing her. He intends merely to reprove her, so he says. But what reproof is possible? And the most alarming feature of the whole situation is that, to my opinion, he's looking forward to the interview."
"That woman must be sent out of the house immediately," said Mrs. Faulkner with decision. "I wonder if higher wages would tempt her."
"I see your idea," answered Tucker. "You think I ought to offer a position. I would do more than that to save Bert."
"A position? As cook, you mean?"
"Why, Mrs. Falconer, what else could I mean?" "Oh, and nothing, so, Lana. I only thought—"
The friends were still explaining away the little misunderstanding when Crane came down and dinner was announced. Mrs. Falconer, with, of course, the heartiest wish to criticize, was forced to admit the food was perfection, the soup so clear and strong, the fried fish so dry and tender, and even the cheese souffle, for which she had waited most hopefully, turned out to be beautifully light and fluffy. Having come to curse, she was obliged to bless, and her praise was delightful to Crane.
"Yes, isn't she a wonder?" he kept saying. "Wasn't it great luck to find anyone like that in such a place as this? Tuck here keeps trying to poison my mind against her, but I wouldn't part with a cook like that, even if she were a Messalina."
Mrs. Falconer, who couldn't on the instant remember who Messalina was, attempted to look as if she thought it would be better not to mention such people in the presence of her daughter.
"Tuck's an inhuman old creature, isn't he, Mrs. Falconer?" Crane went on. "I don't believe he ever had a natural impulse in his life, and so he has no sympathy with the impulses of others."
Tucker smiled quietly. It came to him that just so the iron reserve of the middle-aged hero was often misinterpreted during the first two acts by more frivolous members of the cast. As they rose from the table, Miss Falconer said,
"It's such a lovely night, such a moon. Have you seen it, Mr. Crane?"
"Well, I saw it as we drove over from the station," returned Crane a trifle absently. He had become thoughtful as dinner ended.
"Do you think," said Cora, "that it would be too cold to take a turn in the garden? I should like to see the old box in the cedars by moonlight."
"Not a bit. Let's go out. I have something to do first, but it won't take me 10 minutes. But," he added, "you must not catch cold and get laid up and miss the run tomorrow. I'm going to put you on a new Irish mare I've just bought." and they found themselves talking not about the garden but the stable. In the midst of it, Smithfield came into the drawing room with the coffee, and Crane said to him in a low tone, "Oh, Smithfield, tell the cook I'll see her now in the little office across the hall." Smithfield looked graver than usual. "Beg pardon, sir," he said, "but the cook was feeling tired and has gone up to bed, sir." Crane was just helping himself to sugar. "She cooked this coffee, didn't she?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"She can't have been gone very long, then."
"About 5 minutes, sir."
"Go up and tell her to come down," said Crane. He turned again to Miss Falconer and went on about the past performances of the Irish mare, but it was quite clear to all who heard him that his heart was no longer in the topic. Smithfield's return was greeted by complete silence. "Well?" said Crane sharply.
"Beg pardon, sir," said Smithfield. "Jane Ellen says that she is very tired, and that if the morning will do..."
"The morning will not do," answered Crane with a promptness unusual in him. "Go up and tell her that if she is not in my office within 10 minutes, I'll come up myself." Smithfield bowed and withdrew. Silence again descended on the room. Mrs. Falconer and Tucker were silent, because they both felt that thus their faces expressed more plainly than words could do that this was just about what they had expected. But Cora, who was young enough to understand that anger may be a form of interest, watched him with a strangely wistful expression. After what seemed to everyone an interminable delay, Smithfield entered again. He looked pale and graver than anyone had ever seen his habitually grave countenance.
"Jane Ellen is in your office now, sir," he said. Crane rose at once and left the room, followed by Smithfield.
Join me next time for another romantic chapter of Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.